You're about to listen to a Second City Works presentation, brought to you in partnership with WGN Radio. Subscribe on your favorite podcast streaming platform or listen on WGNradio.com. And be sure to share.
The Second City is a world-famous comedy theater, and it got so famous because it has produced generation after generation of comedy superstars. That didn't happen by magic. Second City's improvisational pedagogy fuels great performance, and the same practices that have made stars of everyone from Bill Murray to Tina Fey can be applied for success offstage, at work, at home, and in the world. I'm Kelly Leonard, Vice President of Creative Strategy, Innovation, and Business Development at the Second City. This podcast is about collaborative conversations, discovering connections, and building a better future. This is Getting the Yes And.
The nerd in me is so excited for this podcast. Mary Ellen McDonald is the Donald P. Hayes Professor Emeritus of Psychology and Language Sciences at University of Wisconsin-Madison. She is a cognitive scientist with a focus on psycholinguistics. Yeah, I said that correctly. The study of how we comprehend, produce, and learn languages. She has researched the impact of language in children, young adults, elderly adults, and patients with Alzheimer's disease, as well as language production in six different languages. Her new book is called More Than Words, How Talking Sharpens the Mind and Shapes Our World. I know you're going to love the podcast. Mary Ellen McDonald, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me. It is so fun to be here.
When I was reading your book and talking about it to my colleagues, I often had trouble explaining the subject matter. I said it was a book about talking, but not necessarily about communication. So right away, this didn't click. So I'm going to ask you to find a relatively pithy, and it doesn't have to be that pithy, but a relatively pithy way to describe what this book is about.
Yeah. So just first, imagine me pitching it to editors. I got a book about
what
talking.
A nightmare.
It's not about communication. And fortunately, though some people told me I should stop writing that book, I did find an editor who was really enthusiastic. So here's the story. When we talk, we think about communication. Of course, it's for communication. And usually we're thinking about the effect on the person we're communicating with. Do they understand us? Do they like us? Do they believe us? All of that. But inside our brains, there's a whole story about how talking affects the person doing the talking. And you don't even have to have somebody listening necessarily to get these effects of talking. So talking sharpens our attention, helps us regulate and understand our emotions better, helps us follow through with our plans, helps kids develop school readiness, keeps older adults sharp in old age, and all sorts of stuff like that, that are kind of funny side benefits of the way that talking works. And I wanted to tell that story.
Would this phrasing make sense, that there's an inner life to talking that we aren't maybe
we don't have a
knowledge of? Okay. It's hard to categorize, but my colleague Tyler was just in here. He's like, oh, who are you interviewing? And I'm like, I started reading some of these little tidbits from the book. He's like, that's fascinating.
Oh,
and,
good.
And I like that you started with the Diana monkeys and the calls they make that identify specific predators in their environment. This is a savvy way of you getting into the differences and why it's so much harder for us. Can you tell us a little bit about what's happening there with the monkeys?
Yeah. So the Diana monkeys have been studied a lot because they have what seems to be very specific calls. Lots of animals, including monkeys, have calls like, I'm here, or I'm the dominant one, or I'm your mother, or something. They convey that sort of information. But these monkeys have a call that is given when a leopard predator is detected, something on the ground, and another call when a giant eagle is detected. It's just like danger from the air. And mm-hmm. The monkeys in the troop recognize the call and react looking up in the air or down on the ground or try to evade the predators. And the interesting thing about them is that not only do they have these calls that they understand themselves, but other animals in the tree also understand the calls. So there's another species of monkey called Campbell's monkeys that have also have calls, and the two monkeys understand each other's calls, and these big birds, black hornbills, also understand the calls. And so there's this whole community of understanding something that an animal is producing. And I argue in the book that those innate abilities to pay attention to another species have allowed some smart species to understand a bit of human language, but they don't talk themselves.
Right. And as you extend this out, the way you say it very simply is like apes, they lack the ability to inform. So,
right.
All right. So they get it when it's like a danger that where like there's a benefit. But there's nothing beyond that that exists in terms of talking.
Yeah. They do inform, but they inform mm-hmm. only from the hardwired calls that they have. So they mm-hmm. do have calls that convey certain things, but they don't ever learn to use what they've been trained on in terms of signs or button presses on a computer or anything to use that new information to do any informing. They just don't even get that it's something that they could do to convey communication. They think of it as something they can do to get a reward. So doing a sign for a banana to get a banana, and a sign for orange to get an orange, a sign for tickle to get tickled, and all of that. But they don't want to ever talk about a banana outside of asking to get one.
This is a giant leap, and you can say no whatsoever to it. But do people, when they're talking about AI, could they learn something about from this with regard to...
That's a really interesting question. Obviously, AI has learned tons of stuff about how to talk to humans, and it is programmed to do this kind of behavior.
But it's all predictive. But I mean, it's excellent guessing.
Yes.
There's no knowledge.
Right. There's no knowledge except that what it has been fed. And there is excellent guessing. And we do a lot of excellent guessing too, but we also have these other experiences, which are not via a language model. So have emotion and we have interacting with the world. So I think it's not, let me just give you a double negative here, not unrelated.
Yeah. Okay. I mean, I didn't even have this in my notes. It was just something I was thinking because, we talk about AI all the time. All right. We had two kids, and grew up in, my dad was a broadcaster. We all worked in theater, a house full of books, to theater, all that stuff. And this idea that sort of exists in culture of kids as sponges is something that always felt true. And felt true in my household, but you say it's maybe not so true.
Well, they're more than sponges, and they're so much more than sponges that whether you say it's not true or not is kind of dicing the message a little bit. But they are absorbing things, but they are also acting themselves in their world and changing their world. And particularly their talking changes the kind of information they get from people, and their talking tunes their brains in the same way that the talking adults talking benefits them. And so their own actions are changing their lives in important ways. And by thinking about this metaphor of sponges, we don't really appreciate how much mm-hmm. they need to talk and they need to act and they need to offer opinions. And they need to engage in the world more than just being given things, given ideas, given instructions, given patterns that for them to learn, they need to act too.
It's interesting because my kids' babysitters were almost exclusively Second City actresses. And so when Amy Poehler or Rachel Dratch would babysit my kids, there is a rich world that would get built. There'd be characters. They'd go, you know, they'd go spelunking, all these different things. And I got sort of oh, that's kind of fun. And now in my older years, and as I read a book like this, I'm like, oh, what tremendous work was actually being done with that in terms of the kids gathering a sense of agency because they were in this play.
Yes. Yes. And doing improv because they are developing all their ideas and trying to put them together. And as I say in the book, talking has this thing called desirable difficulty, and it is hard work and it is beneficial.
So what's the balance between in a conversation like ours, there's talking and comprehending essentially, right? What's the ratio going on there? How hard is each? What, you know, cause I think we spend a ton of time on comprehending. We don't spend a lot of time on talking.
Right. And that's in the research and that's in our everyday thinking. And people worry about, oh, kids aren't reading enough, or I didn't understand that guy on the phone, or we think about our comprehension a lot, but a lot less about talking. Talking is harder. It runs up to 50% slower than comprehending because it's so hard and you've got so many things you need to do. And we can finish each other's sentences sometimes because we're going so fast ahead of the talker that we know pretty much where it's going to go. And comprehending is obviously important. It's important for kids to read, and it's important for us to understand each other. But understanding why talking is such a good, desirable difficulty and improves our cognition is also very important.
I want to describe an improv exercise to you and get your feedback on what's going on here.
Yeah.
So an exercise that we've done for decades is called Last Word. And it's very simple. The point of focus is very simple, which is two people have a conversation, one rule. And the one rule is that we each have to start our sentence with the last word the other person said. And we have people do that, and we unpack why it was difficult or what. And there's no other rules around here. So often people have invented rules that they're putting on side this. Our point, of course, is we don't listen to the ends of sentences, that we should. There's really vital information at the end there. And that most people are completely comfortable with that pause that happens afterwards when you're considering what they said, because it's like, oh, you're really listening to me. So I'm curious, when you hear this as a lingo, you know, with your fancy title and job as
psycholinguist,
thank you. What do you think?
Yeah, I think that it's such a great exercise, especially toward getting people to listen all the way to the last word. Because the way talking planning works is we put the new stuff that people don't know at the end. What everybody already knows and what you've said before is really easy. It tends to go at the beginning of sentences because we tend to start with the easy stuff first. And so that allows us, it's a very efficient planning strategy, that allows us to plan the harder stuff upcoming, gives us extra time while we're yapping about the easy stuff at the beginning, and the hard, most impactful stuff usually is at the end. So if you're training anybody, police officers or any business leaders or anybody else, to listen more, they'll be listening more to the stuff they don't already know at the end of sentences.
So you use this term, the easy first. This is such an improv thing, because what you have to teach people when you're initiating a scene, you know, you simply have to establish sort of a who, where, what. That's what you have to do right away. So it's like, hey, hey, Dad, it's nice here in the cabin. You know, and then you can go anywhere. But what happens is a lot of people, they think they need to come in with their giant cathedral. And we always say, you know, bring a brick, not a cathedral, to improv scenes. So there's a couple in here I want to talk to you, but the easy first is it makes sense across a variety of mediums because people need a little bit of a warm up. They need to kind of get into this thing. And it could be a pitch. It could be a sales meeting. Getting people to connect to you in some way right away allows for more complex conversation potentially to happen.
That's right. And easy first, you're right. It goes at multiple scales.
Yeah. Here's the other one, which is my wife talks about this all the time, and she's at Second City as well, of the good enough show. So Second City creates its shows through improvisation in front of audiences. We're always in some sort of process. And at certain points, you're not going to have the finished thing. You just have to have the good enough show that people are going to enjoy it. And I know, like, there's certain people, many of my bosses, who hate that idea because they want everything to be pristine. It can't be. Especially when you're creating something out of nothing. It just can't come out as gold. Yeah. It doesn't. Yeah. So yeah. When you talk about good enough talking, are you kind of talking about a similar thing?
Yes, absolutely. Okay. Talking is harder than understanding. The person doing the understanding has a less difficult job, and it's better for everyone if the talker does it in a way that's easier for the talker, because they'll get going faster, we'll get to the interesting part more quickly, and the person doing the understanding has a little bit of extra time to fill in something that maybe wasn't exactly correct. So, for example, if we're walking down the street and you say, let's go to pizza for lunch, and I say, oh, I'm so sick of pizza. There I said, you understood it, but what I actually said was, oh, just this little set of tones. And you, the understander, filled in the tones that I said and made it into, I don't know, I'm kind of sick of pizza. And that's good enough talking.
That's good. We had an interaction with a potential client who discovered they had no budget. And when they were delivering this news, they go, I have to inform you, we have no budget. Womp, womp. And the womp, womp was so funny and lovely because it's a high status person who immediately lowered their status, but also was like, all right, we're good. The womp, womp did work, like real work in that. And we don't parse this stuff because it doesn't feel important. And yet, like most things, this is where all the good comedy comes from, right? Pointing out how important those little things are to us navigating this weird thing called human life.
Yeah. Yeah. That's excellent.
Self-talk. It's a good thing?
Yes. It is a good thing. Nobody should feel embarrassed about talking to themselves. I guess we associate talking to yourself as what people who have mental illness do, but everybody talks to themselves to some degree, and it's a really good thing because we don't always have somebody to talk to, and it is a way that we can help focus our attention and get us going and get us motivated in a way that doesn't happen to have to have a person handy to be our listener.
All right. My local grocery store decided to change where they put everything.
Oh, right. Fun.
So I just want – everyone needs to take a moment and think about how traumatic that is for a place that you've gone for like 30 years to suddenly decide Kleenex is now in aisle two. I do a thing that I thought was dumb, which is I say the name of the product out loud when I'm searching for it. You have told me in this book that that is a good way to find things.
Absolutely. Studies have shown that you're a little bit faster, not 2 days faster, not 2 hours faster. But, you know, if you're trying to plow through the grocery store, it's a fine strategy. Yes. Good strategy.
Yeah, literally. I think for me it was like Old Spice deodorant, Old Spice deodorant, Old Spice deodorant, and they moved it down one and over. My boss, Ed Wells, is bilingual. He speaks fluent Japanese as well as his native language of English. The study of bilingual stuff was fascinating to me, especially in this realm of decision making and where maybe more effective. Tell us about that, because I think that speaks volumes.
It does. I wish I understood the research is pretty new. And so let me tell you about how it goes. People who have a language at the home and then they learned a second language very well, but not necessarily in their home, can do problem solving kinds of activities or think about their budget or plan for the future in either language, but the way they do it seems to be somewhat different, where the language of the home, their first language, is more clouded by emotional biases or feelings, and they're thinking in their second language, they can be more logical and set their emotions aside some. And I don't think entirely we understand why, but a really good hypothesis is that, of course, the language of the home with the mommy and the daddy and the siblings and the going to bed at night or fighting with your siblings has all these emotional components from early life. And the second language is probably learned in school, and it is more logical or is more tied to things that are not emotional. And so there may be a benefit for thinking in your second language about tricky issues or thinking about them in both languages and seeing what you think.
So have you studied any psychotherapy?
A little.
You see where I'm going with this? Because
yeah.
I think there is that same idea of, you know, you're acting a part, which is giving mm-hmm. you some distance from that. Because I was mm-hmm. thinking about how this works with regard to one of my classic lines is no one got into comedy because they're well adjusted. Everyone here is like a broken toy that came here to fix themselves. Yeah. And it's like, well, how is that happening? And you kind of can ferret it out when you think about, okay, well, in improvisation, my job is to save you. Your job is to save me. I look mm-hmm. you in the eye. I listen to you. I see you. Mm-hmm. I build from you. It's all pro-social. It's like, I get that.
Yeah.
But I think there's this other thing of acting as a, that it, and it maybe ties a little bit to the science around fake it till you make it, you mm-hmm. know, like, so, you know, all of this study is just different enough from who I traditionally interview on this podcast and, mm-hmm. and you know, other people. Mm-hmm. It's just different enough to give really lovely color to our understanding of how hard this is. Because that's the thing you repeat over and over, that talking is hard. And I think probably in a good way, we don't let ourselves think that, because mm-hmm. that would make it even harder.
Yeah.
But that's why I think also we value our storytellers, you know, our effective storytellers so much, because it's like, oh wow, you're doing a thing, and you know, it's a special place. Okay, there's so much more here, and we don't have a ton of time, but I want to get to some of this. Can you talk about the vacation we wouldn't want?
This
opens up chapter five.
Yes, yeah. It does. Yes. So the vacation I said we wouldn't want is if we got to take this fabulous vacation with mm-hmm. whatever friends and whatever food and drink and place and all of that stuff. And the minute it was done, every memory of it is gone. Not just conscious memory, but your body is unaffected. Your mind is unaffected. None of your friends remember going. There's no lasting effect whatsoever of having taken this vacation. And I use that in chapter 5 as a metaphor for how some aspects of our education system work, where we pour information on kids' heads or adults' heads in college, you know, try to pour information into them, and they don't remember it later. Maybe they remember they heard that lecture, but they don't actually remember anything about it. And that's because we don't ever learn anything long term unless we can act on it ourselves. And so this goes back to little kids needing to be actors in the world, and middle-sized kids need to be actors, and teenagers and adults. And to learn, you have to do something with it. And sitting there comprehending gives you a feeling that you are learning, because you're understanding what the person says, but actual learning happens overnight through this action of a part of your brain called the hippocampus, and it never says, okay, I've done something for you, or I didn't do mm-hmm. anything for you. You just don't know whether you've learned anything. So what you know is that you understood that lecture, and you think you learned it, or you figured out that problem in your math book, and you think you've learned it. So... but you have to do something with it in order to learn it.
So this idea of active learning, it is what we do, right? Where we do mm-hmm. these embodied mm-hmm. exercises.
Yes, yes.
I was on a call yesterday because I'm going to co-lead an exec ed program at University of Chicago, and I'm doing the improv part. And one of my co-facilitators, who is not an improv person, was saying, like, well, what do you do when someone doesn't want to do this? And I'm like, I've never had that happen. I've had people be a little bit reluctant then get into it. But I think we're kind of self-selected for that, because if you're agreed to do this thing, you're probably going to be okay with it. And you would think that people, if active learning is better for you, like it's going to make you learn things, you'd think that people would be all over it. But you actually say, like, most students don't want to do it.
That's right. They don't want to do it. And I've been, as an academic, I've been on committees where you evaluate young faculty for tenure. And one of the rules about those committees was you couldn't really evaluate the candidate's teaching if they were doing an active learning exercise, because the students hate it so much, they'd give the professor bad evaluations, even though, you know, the studies show they're learning so much more. And you would deny this fabulous teacher tenure because you've misunderstood how this situation works. Yeah.
When you're in your classroom, has this affected the way you teach?
Yes, it has. Though the infrastructure of education is so hard that there are really limits. I do know people who have given up their whole lectures and had students listen to little 15-minute or 20-minute YouTube videos on their own time, and then have the whole classroom spent doing active learning, pairing up, doing problems together, talking to each other, writing down their explanations for why the effects are the way they are and all of that. And lots and lots of studies show that that kind of activity, reducing the lectures and having more action, does lead to learning.
All right.
Students have been schooled not to believe that. And yeah. Teachers too, actually.
Yeah. Well, they're defaulting to the easier thing.
Mm-hmm. That's
which is
right.
Which is the less effective thing, which is always the case, right?
Like, yeah.
At what point was anything worthwhile easy? Never.
Yeah.
You do a fair amount of kind of myth busting, which is kind of interesting. And one of the things you noted was that 2,500 years ago, ancient linguists in what we would now call India and Pakistan worked to understand the grammar of Sanskrit and wrote it down so young people would stop ruining it.
Yes, they were screwing it up. It was the language that the gods had put the rules in, and it was holy. And oh my God, they were screwing it up. And we need to figure out. And they believed that if they could just write it down, they would stop the process of language change over time. And
how'd that work out for them?
Didn't work. We still have those grammars. They are famous among linguists for being incredibly insightful and are still used to this day in research. Didn't change the language change over time, though. They could not stop it.
All right. So I know people who can't stand it when younger generations say no worries.
Absolutely.
Right. You've heard this as well.
Yes, I have.
So what's going on there? It's the same thing, right? Where it's like language changes.
It does.
You're attaching an ethic or a moral to it.
That's right. And those people don't realize that in their youth, they were changers. And they did things that changed the language that really pissed off somebody else. And now they're in a sort of more, I don't know, fossilized state of the way the language is. And they want to see it continue on, because language seems to be rules to everybody. And they don't want people violating the rules of how things ought to be.
So the one thing that annoys me is when people say all the time, including from myself. Is that also live in this category, or is that something different?
Is really helpful. It's really annoying. So the person has to think about how much they should allow themselves to say I'm sure I've said a million times here because I'm thinking of new things to say. And having planned the easy part of what I've said, I now have to plan the harder part. And if I run out of enough stuff to plan so that to allow me to start talking, I need to somehow do this extra stretching. And and like and you know what I'm saying, and you know what I mean, and all of these little phrases are strategies to buy the talker extra time to give themselves extra time to keep planning and keep executing what they want to say. And so it's effective, but it's also annoying.
Yeah.
You know, I said in the book that there's a study that like is the fourth most common word in young adult vocabulary in the U.S. And even I think, wow, that's a lot of like.
It's a lot of like. It gets very repetitive. Personal pronouns. This is a thing. Mm-hmm. You talk about the science about this because it you know, my wife is a college professor. We both work at Second City as well. Mm-hmm. And so we're very much on the cutting edge of like, you want to be called something different? We're going to have to get used to calling you something different.
Right.
But it's hard.
It is hard.
And you give a good reason why it's hard I've never heard anyone else explain why.
Well, sometimes changes, like somebody else saying no worries, mm-hmm. sort of is a way that your comprehension is being affected there. And that's annoying to people. But asking someone to use different pronouns or a person's pronouns is actually asking their talking system to make adjustments. And as we've said, talking is harder. And that's why that's a harder ask than being confronted with somebody saying no worries. More specifically, I think, and I haven't done the studies, but I think that the pronouns, which are a whole intricate system, are contributing to making the choice of like third person pronouns, like using they for someone, they, them. That person who uses they, them pronouns also still uses common pronouns that we all use. They use I to talk about themselves, and they say you to talk about you, and they say we. And so in this system, people are getting reinforced to use the old common ones a lot of the time when discussing this person, and only for these two, they, them ones, or three if you want to say themselves, are the ones changing. And that system of partial deviation is actually known to be really hard in other parts of language.
Yeah, that makes so much sense. And it is just and I like how you say this, which is also like, hey, if someone wants to be called something, like call them that. Like if I change my name or I don't like the longer version of my name or whatever, no one thinks twice about that. So like, just do it. But also be gracious with regard to people figuring that out, because it's sort of a cognitive load. I could talk to you forever about this. I love the book so much. We always end the podcast with a yes and story, and I can't wait to hear what yours might be.
Okay. Well, it's actually about the book. So, several years ago, I was doing all my professory things, but I really wanted to write a book for general audiences, and I didn't know how I could fit it in. And I also really thought that, gosh, I need help doing this. I've never done this sort of thing before. Surely there's a learning curve here. And how do I get a consultant or somebody to give me advice? And at one point, I got an email that was probably sent to every faculty member in my university that said that the Institute for Humanities at my university was taking applications for a summer book writing workshop. And the people in the workshop would get together and they'd help each other. And there was some money to get some consultants. And I thought, oh my God, sign me up. Where can I apply? And then I read the fine print. And it was like specifically for humanities faculty, like English or history. And I'm a psychologist, so I didn't fit that. And it was for people writing their second book. This was my first book, and it was a scholarly book, and it wasn't, you know, I wanted a book for general audiences, and so much for that. And then I rethought it. I thought, you know, it could be really useful just to apply, because I would have to send in a writing sample for this book that didn't yet exist. So I'd have to write something from the notes that I had, and I'd have to send in a an explanation about why I wanted to do this particular book, and that could contribute to writing a book proposal one day. And so I decided to do it anyway, even though I was completely, it was really inapplicable to me. And I did it, and I got in. And it was so wonderful that I did this thing that was just really a low probability thing. And it's true that the actual writing of it was helpful for me, and the whole program was really useful. So
I love
that's my yes and.
That is a great yes and story. The book is called More Than Words, How Talking Sharpens the Mind and Shapes Our World. Mary Ellen McDonald, thank you so much for coming on the podcast.
Thanks.
Getting the Yes And is produced by Second City Works and WGN Radio. Our editor is Iridian Fierro from WGN. We get support at the Second City from Emma Smith and Colleen Fahey. For more information about the Second City, you can go to www.secondcity.com, or you can email us directly at works@secondcity.com.